This is Linux Journal Insider for issue 199. Hack this for November 2010. How are you doing, Kyle?
Doing all right. It's like the hack this. I always think of, you know, like the Godfather or Sopranos. Like, hey, hack this.
Well, you actually did hack something this month.
That's true. Yeah. So in addition to the articles we're going to talk about, I also have an article about this China Vision Pico projector, which was like a fun project. I started out just reviewing the projector itself, but it sort of quickly devolved into trying to get root on the thing. So, you know, even before I got the projector, I knew it ran Linux. You know, I was like, this is really interesting. I wonder if I can get a root on this thing, because it has Wi-Fi on it. It has, you know, SD card slot, all that stuff. And they tell me, well, it's kind of burned. The ROM's burned in. You can't really – I talked to the manufacturer. You probably can't get access to the actual Linux shell underneath. I'm like, okay, well, that sounds like a challenge. And so, yeah, I write in the article about how, you know, it's really easy. In fact, you fire up the device, get it on your network, and you'll find it has Telnet wide open. Awesome. Yeah, the rest of the article is just me hacking around on it, trying to see what kind of Linux, what kind of stuff I can make it do. The challenge, though, and I hope that this inspires some other guys to get this device and try to use it as a platform for something better, because it has a lot of potential, but it's just the user space is really strange. It's like this weird hybrid of – it's not Debian-based ARM, which you'd think most people would use. It's something sort of custom. So it's difficult to get packages to run on it just because of the libraries the base OS has. So.
Oh. And now you actually did some of your hacking on this on an airplane on the way to DEF CON. Is that correct?
That's true. So I throughout using this, I managed to brick it a couple times, either because I did something weird in software or – I did take it apart a couple times, and I'm not sure at what point with me taking it apart that maybe I shorted something, or all I know is that sometimes it would start the boot process and never complete it. And then other times I never got a consistent reason why, because I would just do all of the various guessing voodoo stuff that's not true troubleshooting, where you just like turn it on, turn it off, wait a second, stand on one foot, turn it on again. And then, yeah, on the plane, it wasn't working. Then we got it working. And then the moment I got off the plane, it stopped working again.
So, did you get looks? I mean, you're working on a tiny little device with wires and, you know, telneted into it and all this crazy stuff on a plane. I mean, did you get the, you know, like, please come with me, sir, as you got off the plane, or did nobody really care?
I think everyone, because they all had their little screen. It was a Virgin America flight, so they all had – everyone was so distracted by their own computers right in front of them that are running Linux, by the way. If we did distract people, it was probably good, because we were also having a little bit of fun with the Virgin America consoles.
Okay. So you didn't get, like, arrested and detained or anything?
Yeah, no detentions, and it would be hard to prove after that point, because the Pico projector would stop working. So you're like, oh, what was I doing? I don't know. This doesn't work. So.
All right. Well, hey, my first article is by Carl Lundstedt, and it's about the Large Hadron Collider, which – it's just awesome. Now, I don't know if you're a science nut, Kyle, but I'm a big science nerd, and this is the kind of thing that I love reading about. And what I thought this article was going to be about before I read it, a couple years ago I was speaking with somebody that actually works over at CERN, and they were saying that a lot of their desktops are running either Fedora or CentOS, or some are running Red Hat Enterprise Linux. And I thought, oh, that's cool. You know, their workstations are running Linux. So that's a neat story. But the focus of the article is actually about this global network of grid computing that is crunching through all this data. They export like a terabyte of data a day, and the individual sites around the country, I mean, there's like tier zero is, you know, right at the Large Hadron Collider, and then Tier 1 are like these places, like 8 of them around the planet where they have like terabytes and terabytes. They're expected to store like 300 terabytes of data that they constantly crunch through. It's amazing. Now, I know the Large Hadron Collider is like the biggest, you know, man-made creation of all times. And the network of computers around the planet that's crunching the data has got to be one of the biggest network of data centers around as well. It's just awesome.
Yeah, I thought this was a very, very interesting article. And like you said, I wasn't exactly sure what to expect when I first saw the topic, and then I started reading into it, and it just became this really cool article about what you do when you have to set up open source systems at that scale. You know, most of us don't get to deal with, you know, 1,500 CPU cores processing 800 terabytes with 800 terabytes of disk storage. I mean, some people do, but, you know, I certainly don't, not yet. Yeah, not many. And it's just interesting what kind of problems you have when you're dealing with something at that scale and have all this gigantic distributed network where you have to have everything communicate with each other. You know, it's just really, really interesting article.
It is cool. And my favorite part of the article was the end. At the end, Carl talked about even if you don't know your quark from your meson, it's all of the efforts of the open source community that has been building awesome and powerful software for years and years. And that's what they've based this entire huge global infrastructure on. So he kind of gives a shout out to the whole open source community saying, you know, without us, this awesome thing that they're doing wouldn't be possible. So I just love that, you know, the community, even if it has nothing to do with physics, you know, the open source community is contributing to this, to the Large Hadron Collider. It's just cool.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So the article I'm going to talk about, I had no segue from that.
That's okay. I kind of tripped you up there when I started talking about getting sappy about open source community. So go ahead.
Yeah. I guess we're talking about Linux and open source communities at this next article. So Daniel Bartholomew has an article about finding your phone the Linux way, which is actually about my favorite portable phone, the Nokia N900. And he talks about how, you know, the great thing about the N900, and this is something I wrote a review about in the past, is that it's running, it's really like a little Linux computer, you know, even more so than, say, like an Android device, just because you can write shell scripts that do things. You can write, you know, in a lot of different languages, and it exposes, it has dbus hooks and everything in it. So anyway, his article talks about the fact that he was thinking, well, I have this pocket computer that's running Linux and actually can run an SSH server. So if I can run an SSH server on the thing, well, what can I do? What if I lose my phone, which is more likely, or someone takes it? Is there a way for me to get access to this computer and then figure out where it is? And so he talks about a number of different scripts. He gives very good examples of, you know, how to set up SSH on the N900, and then how to do things like use dbus calls to get it to just make the phone vibrate so you can find it, or generate a noise in case, you know, what if you have the phone on silent? You can't just call it and find it.
Yeah.
So how to do that. And then he goes into interesting things like how to get it to take a picture from the front-facing camera. So you could see he has an example of what it would look like maybe if it was laying sideways on his bed or something, looking at his lamp. And then he finally gets into the fact that, you know, this device does have a GPS on it, and, you know, how to remotely enable the GPS and send coordinates to you. So, and all the different scripts he set up to take into account what if the battery starts going low, or how would you locate where it is if you're on a cellular network versus someone's home network. So all in all, I thought it was a really cool article. I mean, even if you don't have an N900, you can adapt a lot of the stuff he says, at least the ideas behind it, for a phone that you have if it's, you know, running Linux. So yeah, I thought it was a really cool article. In fact, it's something I can see myself reading this pretty soon, going back through it and setting it all up on my phone.
That's cool. And, you know, like you were saying, it uses dbus to communicate with the different aspects of the phone. And that's actually what my next article is about, which isn't even a contrived segue. It actually works really well. The article I'm reading is by Cohen Vervloesem. And sorry if I butchered your name there. But it's talking about controlling your desktop computer with dbus. And I have to admit, you know, I've made no secrets about it. I'm not a programmer at all. But dbus is a way that different programs actually communicate, not directly with each other, but through dbus, which is like hooks into applications, or, you know, you can actually communicate with the hardware abstraction layer on your computer and find out, like, if somebody put in a disk or something like that. But what's great about dbus is different applications. Like, he uses a great example of if you want to set your pigeon like status message to what song is playing on your, you know, your music player, you could use Dbus to get that information from your music player and send that information to Pigeon. It's actually a, you know, it's just behind the scenes how you can get information from one program to another. And it's just a really great tutorial on how to go about doing that with different programs, and gives examples from programs that have, you know, a lot of open hooks, and I guess hooks may not be the proper term to use, but basically so you can get information to and from programs behind the scene using Dbus.
Yeah, I thought this was cool because there's a lot of programs that, like just common desktop programs that most people would use nowadays that are capable of using Dbus calls. So, I mean, the best example is the one that you gave with using Pigeon. But, you know, and I've used – the great thing is there's a little bit of a learning curve to trying to get information out of Dbus. But once you learn how it's set up, it's not too difficult either to write, you know, Python or other scripts or even just shell scripts that run a couple one-liners that will query a program and pull little bits of information, you know, like is a particular setting toggled or not, or, you know. In the past when I've wanted to write little scripts that, you know, that supplement something, like pull some information from a program, I've had to either – figure out a way to get the program to export information or try to write something custom that will talk just to that program. But since so many programs now use Dbus, you learn one way to query the program, and then you can write a lot of different things based on that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, really, really cool article. It seems like I'm sort of have the smartphone articles this time.
It's true. You know, it's because you have the cool Linux one. I mean, I have a Droid, but the N900 is like a computer in your pocket. So, yeah.
Yeah, so the next article I'm going to talk about is Controlling Your Linux System with a Smartphone, which is by Jamie Popkin. And so this article is about how you can, if you, for example, it's from the basis of the idea of having a lot of Linux computers on a home network that you can obviously SSH into and do some other things into. But if you're walking around with a smartphone and you can write web services on the different Linux computers around your home, then the smartphone screen is an ideal, since it all has a web browser, to set up a, you know, basic CGI scripts or, you know, using JavaScript or maybe not even using JavaScript that allow you to do, you know, sort of home automation type tasks. So he gives an example here of just a very basic example of making a computer make a noise. But probably the example I like the best is the Big Meanie script, where basically what it comes down to is he has this one computer that's shared. And he wants to make sure that his kids at dinner time will get off the computer. So what his Big Meanie script does is he can press a button on, and he shows screenshots of the interface on his phone. He can press a button that says, you know, says 5-minute warning. And he talks about behind the scenes how it'll do a little pop up letting the kids know, okay, it's time to get off. You have 5 minutes, 4 minutes, 3 minutes. He can cancel it. And then finally, if he says get off now, then he can, you know, force them to get off the computer. So it's kind of a cool little script there. And he also talks about how he used something similar to interface with TV time, how he can basically have a remote control even within a web browser. Now, the interesting thing about this is it's not just that because he's using a web interface, it's not just that it'll work on his phone, but pretty much anyone's phone that can talk to his network could, if he wanted to, use his interface, or even a laptop. If you happen to have a laptop on your lap, you're not limited to using a phone to get this to work. So it's not just like writing a custom app for your environment, it should be pretty universal.
Yeah, and you know, the smartphone interface for things actually makes sense. Like the Boxy Box, which is actually due out, I have mine pre-ordered, and I think it ships sometime in November. But they have a really awesome remote that's going to ship with that. But right now, if you run Boxy, the best remote you can get is actually your phone, whether it's the Android app or the iPhone app. It makes a really excellent remote. And I think that, you know, interfacing with things with your smartphone actually makes sense because, you know, sure, the remote often gets lost in the couch cushions, but, you know, your smartphone's always with you. So it's a really nice thing to have there. But anyway, yeah, it's a great article, again, showing you how to take advantage of that. Again, you know, maybe something that your phone was never intended to do, but hey, it's the hack this issue.
Right.
And instead of reading an entire letter, there's a letter here from J. Mike Needham, and he talks about Flash. Now, at the time when this was written, there was no 64-bit Flash for Linux, or I don't think for anything. I don't even think 64-bit Flash exists for Windows. I don't know. I could be wrong there. But I know it didn't exist for Linux. But right now, you can actually get a 64-bit native Flash player. for Linux desktop. But honestly, it has never really been an issue for me. And Kyle, we were talking before the show, almost every time I have Linux on a desktop or on a laptop, I install the 32-bit version just because it keeps things simpler. And, you know, if the only problem that I would have with a 32-bit kernel is the memory limitation. And then, but if you use the, you know, physical address extension, the PAE kernel, then you can address, like, what is it, I think up to 64 gigabytes of RAM. So it's never really been an issue for me, but it is nice to see Adobe releasing, you know, a native 64-bit version of their Flash Player for those people who do have a 64-bit desktop running.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it easier for when you're installing plugins. You don't have someone who's brand new to Linux doesn't have to now worry about, well, what do you mean I have to have a special 64-bit version of this program, or it doesn't exist, or I have to do these hacks to get, you know, 32-bit players to work and all that stuff. And so it's nice to have something native. But yeah, I mean, honestly, for the last couple of years since 64-bit desktop distributions have been released, there's so many different hacks you run into, mostly because of proprietary things. I mean, anything that's open source, it's relatively trivial to recompile it.
Right.
But it's all these proprietary bits of software. You start noticing things like basically like codec packs or you know, Flash or things like that that give you headaches. So I've always like you, I've always just used a 32-bit desktop. You know, maybe you know in a couple of years everything will just work and it's not going to really matter. But in the meantime, it's, you know, I'd say if you're going to do a desktop, especially if you're new to Linux, I always recommend people use a 32-bit distribution just to make it simpler.
Me too. And now for servers, my servers, I use 64-bit, but, you know, then you're not installing Flash plugins. So it really, you know, there's no problem there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, same here. All of the servers that I would install these days are all 64-bit versions, but I'm running all open source software on there, and it's all, there's no GUI or anything like that, so... You know, Apache runs just fine and runs, you know, great on 64-bit. So.
Exactly. So, all right. Well, that just about does the hack of this issue. Thanks again, Kyle. And I'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Linux Journal Insider for the November 2010 issue. Make sure to pick up a copy on newsstands in mid-October. Subscribers, if you're listening to this, you already have a copy in your hands or it's on its way. Keep an eye out for your postal servant person. We hope you enjoy it. Next month... Now, this is cool. Next month is our 200th issue, and it's also the Reader's Choice issue. So make sure to tune in again, and don't forget to visit us at www.linuxjournal.com. See you next time, Kyle.
See you next time.